This conversation between Jerry Coleman and Walter Langford is being taped on Tuesday, May 10th, 1988, in Adams Mark Hotel in St. Louis.
Okay, Jerry, tell me how you got going in baseball and what you did, where you went in the minors and everything.
Well, when I was very young in San Francisco growing up, it was quite a baseball hotbed then, because at the time that I was there, I played on a team called the Keneally Yankees, which was a minor league team. And that team, believe it or not, had the American League president, Bobby Brown, on it, had Charlie Silvera, who later went to the Yankees on it, had Bill Wright, who went to the Yankees on it, had a pitcher by the name of Carl DeRose, had yours truly, and a lot of top prospects in the area, all gathered together by a scout by the name of Joe Devine, D-E-V-I-N-E. He was a very fatherly type, and was as much interested in the background of the person as he was their playing skills. In other words, in those days, the Yankees had this great sort of tradition that only certain type people belonged in the Yankee uniform. I'm not so sure that's totally true, but whatever, however,
that's the image they project.
Exactly. And the rule then for a scout out there was to get into the home, find out about the parents, the background. And I know Joe passed up some pretty good ball players that went to the big leagues because he didn't like their attitude or their background or didn't think they were the right people. So that's where it all started. And then the Yankee theory and philosophy and image kept being preached to me by Joe, and of course it didn't take much because Joe DiMaggio was then the big Yankee star, and I was growing up through his days as an early Yankee. And my goal at that point was to become a Yankee. That was the one great desire I had in life. And in June of 1942, I graduated from high school. And just prior to that, as you know, in December of 41, the war started. And consequently, at that time, I had a scholarship to USC to play baseball and basketball. My high school coach had me all set up, but when the war started, we all wanted to be heroes. And we couldn't wait to be 18, so I could go into the program I wanted to go into, which was V-5, Victor 5, which was Naval Aviation.
Yeah, we had some of it, Notre Dame training.
Yeah, sure, they had a lot of them there. Anyway, it took me 3 months before I could be 18. I was only 17, so I thought, well, I'll go out and play baseball. So I signed a contract with Devine, which I'd planned on doing anyway, but at that point the war got in the way and everything. So I went out and I played 3 months in Wellsville, New York. I came back, I know the season was over about the 6th of September, and I was going to be 18 on the 14th, and on the 14th or the 15th I was standing at the Ferry Building in San Francisco waiting to go in the service. But that's how I got started anyway in baseball. And then the war ended in 1946. I went with Binghamton. Actually, I didn't go with them. I went to the Kansas City ball club in spring training. That was my first brush with one of the great men of this game that not many people know much about, Billy Meyer, who managed in the minor leagues for the New York Yankee organization for years, and then he became the Pittsburgh Pirate manager. And he had Kiner there and all those great stars then. And he died young, and I went from Kansas City, I was out into Binghamton, then to Kansas City the next year where I played for him. Then I went in 1948, because the weather was so hot in Kansas City, they sent me to Newark, and I played for a guy by the name of Bill Skiff. And at the end of the 48 season, about in late August or early September, I went up and joined the Yankee Ball Club under Bucky Harris, and finished out the year there, and then came up to New York on a full basis in 1949 under my old buddy Casey Stengel, one of the classic characters of the game, but a brilliant manager, the perfect manager.
He had to be. He hadn't been in his previous efforts, but he didn't have the horses and he didn't have the experience.
See, what Casey understood that few managers, maybe Lasorda understands today, is that there's more to managing than just the game. It's the people, it's the front office, it's the press, it's all these little things that are out there that many managers don't know how to deal with. Now, today, Billy Martin is probably, or maybe he's, you know, at this point, used up a lot, but maybe one of the great minds in baseball.
You're right.
And he creates attention. But the thing that I wanted my manager, if I owned a ball club, is somebody that would put that club or his name or his players in the press, because that's your natural advertising. Doesn't cost a nickel.
Absolutely.
And Casey knew how to do this. He could get it done. That's why George Weiss, when he went to the Mets, hired him immediately.
Yeah.
He made the Mets famous. He made the Mets more famous being bad than most people could make that club being good.
That's true.
And yep. So it was a classic situation. I was with him for 9 years, and then I retired, went in the front office, and became the personnel director. And then I soured a little bit because I wasn't going where I wanted to go, and I went into private business and into broadcasting.
I didn't know about that private business.
Well, what I did was, when I left the Yankees, I joined the Van Heusen Shirt Company as their national sales manager in charge of sportswear.
Yeah.
And my job, Carl Erskine was in there with me, and Andy Robustelli, and Jim Hearn, and we developed the in-store displays. There are 8 regions with the Van Heusen Shirt Company, and we would have in-store displays that we'd put into the major department stores. We'd hold little clinics within the store itself and attract attention, and we also opened up the pro shops. Mm-hmm. Van Heusen at that time was a white shirt company.
That's right.
And they wanted to get into the sports shirt, mm-hmm. like the Munsingwear, the little penguin.
Mm-hmm.
They had a torch. And so we went out, sized and styled the line. We came up with what they call a knit shirt,
mm-hmm.
and a golf sweater, which was very popular in those days, all moderately priced. And we opened up hundreds of pro shops all over the country. And what we really did was develop a new line for them and a new resource in their marketing department.
I talked a few months ago with Carl Erskine. Had a great talk with him.
Carl and I started with Van Heusen together.
He's a fine guy.
Mm-hmm.
President of Bank and Anderson.
Yeah. What happened, Carl? See, the situation was I wanted to get to the West Coast, and they told me that I could headquarters out of San Francisco, working that entire 11-state area.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl was going to come into New York,
mm-hmm.
and head up the program, and Jim Hearn was going to go up to Atlanta, and I guess Andy had New England or whatever, and they were going to get a couple of more, somebody in Texas, somebody in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And they trained us. This wasn't a gimmick. We went to school for 6 months.
Yeah.
And learned everything, went with a salesman, went into their plants, learned all this. Well, what happened, Carl was looking for a place in New York. I lived in New Jersey at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, God, Carl, there's a place right next door to me. He's just going out. So he went out, looked at that, and he was thinking about it. But his wife, I think Betty, was that her name?
I didn't meet her.
Not sure.
Yeah.
I think it was. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, she had a baby,
mm-hmm.
and it had Down syndrome.
Oh.
And they were destroyed by that.
Oh, boy.
And Carl, when that happened, he just picked up everything, went back to Anderson, went back to his roots,
mm-hmm.
and of course became very successful. But
when
Van Heusen were looking for someone to head up the program, and I was on my way to California, and when I came back and told my wife that they wanted me to stay in New York to head this thing, it didn't set too well, but we stayed on from 58 through 69 before we finally went back.
Oh, for
but then I went out of the Van Heusen shirt business. Yeah. I got into broadcasting, which became
right.
monetarily more interesting and more attractive, and it was into sports that I loved.
That's right. Remember your first game in the majors?
Yeah, I think I went 0-4. It was against the Philadelphia Athletics, and I think I went 0-4. The next day, I got a base hit. It was one of those 47 hoppers between third and short. And the third game against an Alec Kellner, I went 4-for-4 and won the game with a home run, and that really got me started.
That's right. Great.
So, those I remember. That's all I don't remember much more, I must tell you.
Well, you know, you don't, after so long a time, so much water over the dam, you can't remember every little ball that's hit to you or hits that you made. What about some of your teammates at that time?
When I joined the Yankees, Joe DiMaggio was the peerless center fielder. Charlie Keller and Tommy Henrick were in the outfield, but the new group was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Bauer and Gene Woodling were on the way, and Cliff Mapes was in center field. Johnny Lindell was there as an extra outfielder.
Mm-hmm.
The infield had George McQuinn at first and Tommy Henrick a little bit. And at first base, then they had a rash of people, Dick Krajowski and Jack Phillips. And later in the year, Johnny Mize joined us in late August. He was acquired from the Giants. Second base had George Sternweis. Rizzuto was at shortstop. Had Bobby Brown and Billy Johnson at third, and Yogi Berra and Charlie Silvera and Gus Narahaus and a few others were running around as catchers.
They're sending me away, okay? And don't worry about the coffee. I got the coffee, okay? And I thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Oh, no, that's okay. No,
please.
Take
please. Please come on. Sorry.
Thank you.
I always take it.
Okay.
Yeah, I always take it. The pitching staff was a bunch of guys that were pretty good, but really hadn't found their way yet, but became great. Maybe the greatest pitching staff from a standpoint of winning and losing that ever happened. And it was Dick Rashie, Allie Reynolds,
Lopat,
Eddie Lopat, and Tommy Byrne, and Joe Page, who had a bad year in 48. And then we had others, Clarence Marshall, Fred Sanford, and Spec Shaw.
Yeah, but those were the big guys.
But those four guys, and I remember sitting in the clubhouse in St. Louis, I think it was in late August, and I happened to be, I don't know why I was in there, but Stengel was talking to these five pitchers, Rashie, Reynolds, Lopat, Byrne, and Page. He said, I want you ready every day. You're my five men. Nobody else is going to pitch unless we're out of the game. Be ready every day. So, see, Casey had the ability to understand when to do things. And he knew that if he was going to win it, he could do with those men, but not the other five. And they were ready, and we beat the Red Sox.
What about the last 2 days?
Yeah, well, we can
beating
the last 2 days.
Kinder and Parnell on successive days with the seasons they had was really something.
Well, the amazing part about that was a game that nobody remembers. The Senators and Ray Scarborough were playing Boston in Washington. And at that point, had the Red Sox won that game, they would have come into Yankee Stadium with no worse than a tie if we won both games. And Washington, somebody threw a wild pitch, and Ray Scarborough beat the Boston Red Sox that game. So it set up the stage where the Red Sox came into town with two to play in New York.
Leading one.
And they had a one-game lead. And the Saturday game was maybe the most, the most dismal yet exciting game I ever played in, because in the fifth inning, we were behind 4-0. What happened was Reynolds started that game and went sky high, and in came Joe Page with the bases loaded. The Red Sox, they had 2-0. This had to be the fourth inning, I believe, or maybe the third. Walked the bases loaded with the bases. I walked two men in. It was 40. He walked, the third run in and the fourth run. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a relief pitcher, won 16 games, we're done. Well, a son of a gun steadied, and he shut him out from there on in. And somewhere in the eighth inning or seventh inning, I think, where John Lindell hit a home run against, I happened to be on deck when he hit it. Went around that big pole down at Yankee Stadium, and we won 5-4. And the next day, we were ahead 5-0. In the ninth inning, we figured we had it wrapped up, and they had a tying run at first base when Bertie Kebbis popped up. We nosed him out 5-3. Rashie won that game. He went all the way. And one of the classic stories in that game was Rashie was faltering in the ninth inning. He was tired. It had been a long year, and this was it. It was all out there. So Hendrick, who was at first base, went out and was going to talk to him. And Rashie's kind of said, give me that goddamn ball. And Henry took one look and went back to first base. And that's when he got Tempest to pop up, and that was it. That was probably the highlight of my baseball career, the winning that first year with
And that was Casey's first year with the Yankees.
It was his first year with the Yankees, and he went on then to win 10 out of 12. But at that time, I remember, that somebody picked us third. We were picked all the way down to 6th and 7th, not last, which was
a lot of people. A lot of those guys didn't think Casey was going to be any good as manager of the Yankees.
Well, they didn't know Casey Stengel.
That's right.
Knew him only because he had ball clubs in Boston and Brooklyn. He appeared to be the clown, which he really wasn't. Probably one of the keenest baseball minds I've ever known in my life.
Everybody tells me that. Was Mel Harder a pitching coach for him at that?
No, he was with Cleveland.
He was
a pitching coach.
But he went later with the Mets when Casey was over there.
Possibly.
Yeah. All right. Now, the first game of that series was something too. Going down nothing to the bottom of the ninth inning.
Well, that was the last game. Are you talking about that final game of the?
No, the first game of the series.
Of the World Series. When Henry hit the home run. Well, the funny part about that, I can't give you much detail now because I had something in my eye. And Henrik was a lead batter, and I went back into the clubhouse. I was putting urine in my eye, and I hear this home run. Oh, my God, I'm in the clubhouse. I never saw it.
You were happy here?
No, we're fine. But that was a 1-0 game. The next day was a 1-0 game.
That's right, the other way. Preacher Row.
Preacher Row shut us out.
whether the Yankees established the all-time jinx on Newcomb in that first game, I don't know, but he never could win one in the series.
Well, he opened up in Brooklyn, I think, in one of the games, and Barrett nailed him for a couple of home runs.
Yeah.
There was only one writer who picked up on that, Milton Gross of the New York Post at that time, went after Newcomb, because that was a real story. The failure of a guy that won 27 games, not be able to get out of the World Series.
Yeah.
And Don, who's a super guy, you know, I'm sure it doesn't set well with him when he tries to look back, but
no.
Most of us get over those things.
Yeah, you have to. Sure. Well, then in the Crypto series, first of all, you were, as I recall, the AP Rookie of the Year in 49.
I was, right. That's correct, yes.
And then in the 50 series, if I recall, you were voted the MVP.
I was. I was faced with a lot of game situations. Mm-hmm. You know, you can play a lifetime and never have it happen to you.
Yeah, I think I remember that in the third game of the 50 series, the score was 3-2, and you drove in two and scored the other one.
I think so. I had a good
you drove in the last
game.
One.
I drove in the last one. Yeah, that was... mm-hmm. The pitch. I can't even remember. It's so
yeah.
long ago. But.
It's interesting to me, looking at the statistics for the year yesterday, that in that 49 season, as great a year as it was, the Yankees had nobody that drove in
100 300.
Runs. Nobody drove in 100 runs.
Yeah,
either.
And only Charlie Silvera hit 300, I think, but he was a first-time player.
That's right, yeah.
Nobody, none of the regulars hit 300. The next year, everybody had good years. Zito was the MVP,
yeah.
Mize had a big year, DiMaggio had a big year.
But you still, those first 3 years, you won 90, 97, 98, and 98. Practically, you couldn't have been more regular, more consistent about it. 50 was Page's last year. He had, something that's pretty sure to happen with nearly 90% of the relievers that are great relievers, that they're going to have 2, 3, 4 fine seasons and then they tail off through maybe overwork or something?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there are people have gone by that.
Fingers,
Gossage, people like that have gone by.
But so many of them.
Dick Raddatz, a couple of years.
You could draw a list that long. Of the guys that come through great and then all
Mike
of a sudden...
Mike Marshall with the Dodgers a couple of years. Hmm. I don't know what it is. I think... What they begin to feel is that they're supermen and that there's no tomorrow and they can do it forever. And the manager relies on them to the point he knows that's how he's going to win and he just burns them out.
Speaking of that, some people say that Billy Martin, as great a manager as he's been, in his first year or two, everywhere he's been, he just takes them right up to town. But with the A's, he used his four-man staff of McCaddy and whoever it was, Norris and Langford and some others. They pitched more complete games than anybody had.
5 or 6,
But
and maybe too much.
They're never much good after that.
I don't know if that's, but, you know, Norris had a drug problem.
Yeah,
that was
that's
his
right.
problem. But the rest of them, I don't know that much about.
Yeah. All right. In 51, it was DiMaggio's last season, and you beat the Giants in 6 games in the series.
Day of rain saved us.
Is that right?
Yeah, the Giants had us down 2-1, as I recall. And we had to pitch Sane, who was not one of our starters, because none of our starters were ready, and it rained, and then we brought Reynolds back, and we beat him, and we went from there to win the series. But I remember the day of rain was very instrumental in helping us.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows, Sane might have shut him out, too, I don't know. But at the same time,
he was past his great year.
You felt better with Reynolds than you did with Sane, so we got a break there.
Now, after that, you went into the service.
Went into the service.
You played
52,
a few games in 52.
17, 18, 20,
was that the beginning of the season?
I played until May the 1st.
Okay.
And then...
Were you in the Navy then?
Right, in the Marine Air Corps. Marines were part of the Navy, of course.
Yeah.
And what happened in June or July of 1950, when the North Koreans came south, the Marines committed a wing and a division. And everybody thought, 6-month war, a skirmish will be over in a hurry. Well, suddenly, this thing kept going and going. And the Marine Air did not train a pilot, maybe a handful, from 1945 to 1950.
Yeah.
They didn't train any pilot. They didn't need them. They had an abundance. Well, suddenly, here's a war on their hands that's going on, and they had to come up with some pilots in a hurry. Well, people aren't aware of this, but when if you're an officer in the service and you go out of the service, you're not separated unless you go through an act of Congress to get separated. You're just put on an inactive status.
Yeah.
So in 1945 or 6, he thought about another war in 4 years.
True.
Anyway,
same thing happened to Ted Williams.
Well, he and I are in the same group. What they did was the Marines picked about 1,200 pilots, I believe the number was, and I could be wrong. Senior first and junior captains, and Ted and I were junior captains, and we happened to fall in this category. In fact, the three people that I roomed with and lived with for 2 years in World War II weren't called because they were first lieutenants and I was a second lieutenant. They were out of that category.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back for that, I think it was a 17 or 18 month recall. And, and the funny part of it was, and this is rather strange, because they called me in January of the year before and asked me if I wanted to volunteer. And I said, well, I said, okay, I hadn't thought about it that much. Mm-hmm. He said, well, we're going to get you. This was almost a year before, and I said, well, you do me a favor, if you get me in October, I only missed 1 year. What they did, they got us in May and let us out in September, so we missed 2 full years.
Right.
And it came at the wrong time, anyway.
Now, in World War II, where were you stationed?
I was in, overseas. I was stationed in the Philippines and in New Guinea and Lae.
Oh, was in the Pacific.
The South Pacific. I first landed at Guadalcanal.
Oh, boy.
It was secure at that time. Then I went up to a little place called Green Island. We ran missions in the Kabyang and Rabaul. They were the strongholds in the Southwest Pacific at that time. Then we were the first group. We came under MacArthur in the Philippines to use close air support. It was really our Marine Air Group 24, I think it was, had 7 dive bomber squadrons. And we were trained specifically to bomb ahead of the troops, 100 yards away, I mean, really close stuff.
Yeah.
And so the Army, we went in with MacArthur's troops into the Philippines and supported them all through the Lingayen Gulf and Mindanao and into Borneo and places like that.
And in Korea, you were operating out of South Korea?
Yeah, I was at what they call K-6. Every airfield in Korea had a K attached to it, from 1 to 35 or whatever. And we were just south of Seoul by about 70 or 80 miles, and maybe 100 miles south of the DMZ. And we would go on what they would call deep interdiction strikes or close air work, or, you know, if there was movement, and things were hot, we'd be on a round-the-clock alert going in to help the troops on the ground. But it was, again, close air work.
Now, you might not like to admit it, but you were a hero in...
How about survivor?
Hero to... Survivor is a good term, for sure.
I think survivor is a better word.
I read somewhere, you flew a total of 120 missions, I read.
Yeah, that doesn't make you a hero.
Well,
it makes you showing up.
you got to have something going for you. You got distinguished flying crosses and air medals and Navy citations and everything else. Then
long time ago.
Then come along and be a Rookie of the Year and MVP in the World Series.
I'm fine, thank you very much.
All right, when you came out, by that time, Ford had returned, and MacDougall had arrived, and Billy Martin had arrived.
Well, so Billy came in 50, and MacDougall came in 51 I went in.
I knew that,
And the funny part, when I came back, when I went out, or in, Martin took my job. When I came back, he got drafted, so we got
traded off.
Well, no, he was actually drafted in 52 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then I never really played as well after. See, I was almost 30 years old when I fell out. And never really, I mean, I could give you spurts, but I just didn't have the staining power to do it. And I lost the years at the wrong time, really.
That's right. World War II delayed your arrival.
Well, I was younger then, so you overcome things when you're
20. Yeah, I know, but you arrived later in the majors because of World War II.
23 or 4
years ago. Yeah. Had 103 wins in 54, but you were still 8 behind the Indians because they set the record.
You know, we went into Cleveland. I remember that. We were in Cleveland. We were 4.5 back. We had a doubleheader.
Mm-hmm.
This was in mid-September. Yeah. And we lost both games, like 3-2 and 4-3 tight games, and that put us out. They went 6.5 ahead, and that we never really came back again.
First, and their four-man rotation was the only one that could match the
best
ones you
pitching.
Had.
Well, they had the best pitching staff I've ever seen.
I can believe it.
Over Feller, Lemon, Wynn, and Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
They had Narleski and Mossy in the bullpen, and
right.
They had Hudeman and Newhouser.
That's right. Just on the side, just for fun.
This was the best pitching staff ever saw. For 8 men, I never saw anything like that in my life. These were all superior to great pitchers by themselves. You know, half of them in the Hall of Fame.
Sure. And still they get wiped out in the series.
Yeah, well, that's who I remember saying that. 4 in a row, Giants beat them, and Dusty Rhodes, I guess, did it all.
Dusty beat them. Al Lopez told me, he said, if we'd played, he's right. And this, we played the first, if we'd opened in Cleveland, we'd have won the first game. Because Mertz's blow would have been way out, and Rhodes wouldn't have had a chance to hit his little dinky fly ball, and if he had, it would have been an easy fly to catch in the outfield.
That word, if, is an awful tricky word.
That's right. That's
and better left unsaid.
In 55, the Dodgers finally broke your spell over them, and Padres had quite a series.
Johnny Padres with his changeup. See, our guys, we were a good fastball-hitting club, and the changeup was a trick pitch for us, and a lot of our guys couldn't handle it. I didn't play much in that 55 series. Yeah. Maybe 5 or 6 games, but not full games.
Yeah.
And which is not why we lost. Believe me. But Padres just simply out-pitched. He won 2 games, I recall, and Levine was sharp, too. You know.
Padres... I guess he didn't win 3, but he won the 2.
Yeah, he won the key game.
The
key one. That was the one
Shut
where Hammers made the reaching off into the gloaming, and there it was, you know.
Then in 56, you got back at him, and tell me what you remember about Larson's perfect game.
Well, only that, kind of sneaked up on you. It was about the 7th inning, and the funniest part about that game, I happen not to have played in that game. I'm sorry, I would love to have played in a game like that. I did play in a perfect game in the minor leagues, but never in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is a classic of all time.
Oh, yeah.
As we got down to the 9th inning, everybody on the bench became a manager. You know, hey, look at the guy. Do you think this guy yelling at Farley?
Yeah.
Everybody's positioning people, you know, and running up and down. Right. Stinker looks right at him. Shut up! Damn it, I'm the manager on this club. We all sat down and just watched after that.
Yeah.
But we were giving Casey a lot of help. But that was an, you know, and who knows about the last pitch, you know. I guess it was going to be a strike no matter what. So.
If it had been in the dirt, you would have called
that's
it a
right.
strike.
I think so.
Dale Mitchell went to his grave, of course, contending.
Having a high pitch.
He should have known not to take it.
Too late. Too late.
57 was another series win.
No, we lost in 57. That was disappointing.
Well, that was to Milwaukee.
Yeah, well, that was disappointing for me because it was the worst series I ever played. I did things there that I second-guessed myself on over and over again. I recall we lost that game in extra innings.
I remember you.
We lost one game in extra innings, and that was a game that Howard hit the home run to tie it up in the 9th.
Uh-huh.
Then they beat us. But in that game, I had a runner at second base, and I could hit to the right side all day long if I wanted to. But in this case, it was late in the game, and I thought, I'm not going to sacrifice myself. We're down by 3 runs.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, I hit a ball to the shortstop, and the runner froze, who was Andy Carey, who was not a very good base runner, and then Lumpy got a single. Carried and scored. And if I had, you see, that would have made it 4-2, and the home run by Howard would have won it for us. But these are all, you can go
that's
through this
right.
and drive
some more
crazy.
Was that the series when Burdett won 3?
He won 3. Yeah. And, you know, the first game he was unhittable. The second game, we just, and the third game, he still don't know how he beat us. You know, one of those things, he didn't have much stuff, and he beat us anyway.
He had a rabbit's foot or a lucky charm all along.
Well,
he's the guy that.
Remember one of our guys.
Yeah, Haddix pitched 12 perfect innings.
Was that the guy?
And Burdett gave 13 hits, but beat him in the 13
innings.
Well,
Lou was a Yankee, you know.
Yeah.
And was traded to Milwaukee for same.
Didn't turn out.
No. Well, we got a lot from Sane at the time, but Burdett over the long was a better pitcher, obviously.
Yeah, all right. So, What do you remember as your best game in the majors?
Any time I got a hit, I guess. I don't know. I mean, good God, who knows?
Well, your average was very respectable.
Well, it early on, the first 3 years it was okay. Yeah. I was into the 270s, but the last, parts of two and the last three. Yeah. I didn't play much, and I was
true.
And I didn't hit too well. I broke my
you
car
have,
55.
You had 263
lifetime. Yeah.
Lifetime. You were 268 in your last season, which you dropped off in the middle there.
Well, in 1955, when was my first year back? 54.
54, you were 217.
Yeah, that was the year I had my eye problems.
Uh-huh.
In 1955, I broke my collarbone and got beaned. I was out 3.5 months.
Uh-huh.
Well, and then I started to come back a little bit, and they finally offered me a job in the front office, and I said, I'll take it.
Take it and run.
Well, it was on my career.
Your biggest thrill, you say, was the first season, winning the pennant, winning the World Series.
No, winning the pennant. The World Series anticlimactic, really. I was glad to win, but for the money, really. But the thrill of that first year was exciting.
That money looked big in those days, but it certainly would be peanuts today.
I got a check for $4,400, and I thought it was $4
million. Yeah. Yeah, I checked up yesterday just for fun to see what the winner's share was in those series and the losers when you lost.
Well, the winners, I think, was 55 or 6, but I got the actual check was 4,400, and I thought that was, my God, I'll never spend this while I live to be a millionaire. It was gone about 3 weeks, I hope.
Think of any offhand right at the moment, any funny incidents through the years there when you were active, amusing, unusual.
Oh, God, they're endless, and they've been told before, you know. I just, and I'm not, you know, I really have trouble with memories, such like that. I don't, I get in situations with old-time players, and God, the things they remember, and I remember on recall, but I can't pull them out of my head. They're so far submerged.
Yeah, a lot of people are that way.
And I just, the things that I remember was that I came along at the perfect time.
Sure.
And I was surrounded by a lot of good players who were dedicated and were team players. Mm-hmm. And there was rarely even the DiMaggio and the rest of them were all part of a unit.
That was one of the secrets of the Yankees' long-term success, was that team effort.
And we were lucky to believe in something. The dollars were important for us. We wanted to get rich and famous and all that stuff, but it was always subservient to the unit. And I think that was such an important thing, because when you have something to believe in, and an ideology that is bigger than yourself, then I think you're lucky, because people who don't have that don't know what they're missing.
Absolutely.
I really feel that. I think that's so vital and so important, and I hate to see these people that, you know, I know money's important, I know it's a lifetime situation, get a big contract, you'll never have to worry again as long as you live, but they don't really have that unit feeling that is so important for the Marine Corps, it's so important to the old Yankees, it's so important to anything that involves that little
group activity. All right, now, after being in the Yankee front office and working with
Lee McPhail was there, George Rice was there, Johnny Johnson, who just recently died, became the president of the National Association.
Mm-hmm. Then working with the shirt company.
Then went to Van Heusen. Well, Van Heusen, see, this was a combination. While I went from the Yankees, and I realized that this wasn't where I was going, because they brought in Roy Heamy.
Oh, yeah.
And Roy liked to do all the things I wanted to do, and my position started to erode, and I suddenly found myself as a glorified scout, which I didn't want. And I got the Howard Cosell of all people introduced me to the Van Heusen people. They were looking for people like me, sports people to do their sports work stuff. And while I was in that, Bill McPhail, who was a very dear friend of mine, we grew up together in the Yankee organization, was then president of CBS Sports.
Is that one of Larry's sons?
That's his Larry. See, there's Lee McPhail, Bill McPhail, and there's a daughter in there, I think it's Mary Ann or something like that. So I had three daughters. And Bill was the president of CBS Sports, and he offered me a job as a pre- and post-game host with Reese and Dean on the Game of the Week. So I'm selling shirts and broadcasting at the same time. And after the season ended, they offered me a job, which you hear so often, 10 spots on the CBS radio network on weekends. And I had a writer, and I just read this stuff. And then from that, it led into the Yankee play-by-play, which I enjoyed sports. And the shirt business, I wasn't unhappy doing, but I wanted to be in baseball.
Yeah.
You were with Mel Allen and Red Barber, so.
Mel Allen, Red Barber, Phil Rizzuto, Gary Jola came in when Mel left. And that started in, I started with them in 62, I think it was. Stayed through 69.
And then between 70 and 72, you went out to L.A.?
I went to, see, my home was the West Coast, and my wife, my first wife, who I loved dearly, hated the East because of the weather. She wanted to get home to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Well, I started looking about 2 years in advance for a job on the West Coast, and there were no jobs open. The Giants were loaded with Hodges and Simmons, and I forget, I don't even know if Oakland was, yeah, Oakland was out there, but I don't know who they had for. They had people, and there was nothing in L.A., and there was just no job there. So finally, I told my wife that when our kids got out of high school, we'd head west. And they got out of high school. So now the time was, how do I get out there? And I ended up in Los Angeles at KTLA doing the early and late news, and also had the ABC radio network shows on weekend.
Yeah.
And from that, I'd seen Buzzy in 68, Buzzy Baldassi. And I said, Buzzy, I know you're going to San Diego, and I'd like to work for you. And he said, oh, you know, he hired three other people, so that was all right.
Yeah,
but then I saw him in June or July of 71 in Chicago. He said, I want to talk to you. I said, I could talk to you too. And that's how the project ended up. And I've been there ever since, and I've never been happier.
That's great. I can understand. We were never happier than the years we spent in San Diego.
Yeah,
I told you. Before we moved back here, just to be closer to all our children and grandchildren.
That's the important thing.
Sure is.
Whether or not as important as family.
We sure miss San Diego, I'll tell you that.
I know, it's nice, but the family's better.
Yeah, you're right. All right, now, the Padres, of course, as with any, I guess no expansion team has ever done much in the first few years. The California Angels got up to second place pretty early.
They were in a hurry and then faded.
That's right.
Dean Chance and a few others got them there.
But poor old Padres didn't have it in those first years. When I was out there, you know, I was researching to write a book on the history of the Padres. And I'd done the research through 69, 70, 71, maybe and so forth when we decided to come back here, and I dropped it all. I'm sorry that I never got to finish that, but they were in big trouble, and
they didn't have any economic resources.
That's right.
See, Arnold Smith wasn't putting any money in the club, and Buzzy couldn't sign players. And
yep. So, they're lucky that old Ray Kroc came along.
Ray Kroc. You know, I was there when they sold the club, and it was announced in May of 73.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lame duck season, basically.
Yeah.
And we waded through that and finally to the end. And then I recall vividly the club was on its way to Washington, and I didn't even have a job. And I was waiting to think, to see what. And then the news started to filter down. The Dan Zansky thing didn't connect, and it looked like the National League was going to run the team. And I, you know, and then suddenly in January of that year, Kroc made the phone call and bought the club, and literally changed the lives of hundreds of, and maybe tens of thousands of people by the club staying there. Just changed the world for us.
And from then on, things were looking up, at least, and they kept improving until they finally pulled the 84.
The miracle of 84.
Yeah, that
out of the blue.
And it's a dirty shame that Ray wasn't still alive to see that.
He died that January.
Yeah, that's right. How is Joan Kroc as owner?
Well, I think, to me, Joan Kroc is the perfect owner. From this standpoint, she has unlimited resources.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
for sure.
And in baseball, when you talk about any franchise, if a franchise is weak economically, they suffer
they're
up and down
trouble.
The line. Everybody suffers. And Joan does have the money, and she's a delightful person. She sold the club once primarily because the press in San Diego blamed her for the problems of the ball club. And she said, I don't need this.
That's right.
Well, since that time,
Chuck
Feeney has come in. He's been the buffer between the press. And it's worked. She seems to be happy as a clam. I hope she stays there, because if you have a major league franchise of any nature, you must be able to sustain this franchise in down years. And
that's
she
right.
can do that.
Truth,
I think she has fun with it. I think it's the kind of a thing that if we win, that it'll be heaven for her. But right now, there are some stormy days because we're not winning.
Now, whose idea was it to bring Chubb in?
You know, I don't know. I think Ballard Smith did that. Ballard was in a position where, not from a standpoint of knowledge or anything else, but the PR situation had gotten to the point where it almost was that he'd have to move on. And as far as I can gather, and I've never asked, and I don't really know, I think that Ballard probably was the one who said, look, I think Chubb would be a good man for you. He'll just retire from the National League, knew everybody, and could create that buffer situation that Joan needed. She didn't want to be involved with all this garbage. And she's a lovely lady. From the standpoint of having fun with it, if you're not going to have fun with something like that, why do you want to deal with it?
You don't have to.
So anyway, I'm guessing Ballard.
You think
really
Chubb's going to stay around?
He signed through 1990.
I know that's
89, 90. It's two more years anyway. Well, I think he'd like to stay as long as it's pleasant for him. I don't think it's an economic thing for him. I think he wanted to be involved.
Do I read that Jack McKeon's contract ends this season?
No, I think it's next year. A lot of people have read things into that, and I don't know where it stands, but I don't see why. You know, McKeon and Feeney couldn't work together perfectly. Chubb's actually got the final decision. Jack's in the baseball end of it. Jack does a lot of wonderful things out there. He put this club together, and
sure did.
You look at Santiago, you look at Alomar, you look at Kruk, you look at Gwynn. These are all McKeon's people.
That's right. Yep.
So he's done a lot out there.
Is the other Alomar as great a catcher as they say he is?
Yes. Well, I don't know about it. I know he can throw with Benito Santiago.
Yep.
This spring, we had the three best throwing catchers I've ever seen in one camp in my life. Santiago, Alomar, Mark Parent can throw. But not with these two, just a shade less. But, I mean, you don't find three catchers like that in any camp.
You don't find one of them in most camps.
Two of them, Walter, were Santiago and Alomar are A-plus in throwing.
Can either one of them play another position?
I don't know. I guess they could, but, I have the feeling one of them, and probably Sandy Alomar Jr., will be
traded
for whatever value we can get back, and it should be a lot.
It should be.
Because he can catch.
Yep.
But when I gather, I've only seen him catch a few games, but I know he can throw. And you get an arm on a catcher, and you've got a big, valuable piece
sure
of real
estate. These days, especially.
Yeah. Yep.
But they don't have any great pitching prospects coming up in the farm system.
No,
I see.
Nothing. There are no Goodens or Clemens out there, if that's what you mean. No. Not right now, though. I don't know what
Jimmy Jones hasn't been what they thought he was going to be, I don't believe.
Well, there are people who are still thinking, I do too, that he can be an excellent pitcher, but still today, the best pitcher in our club is Shao.
Exactly. Yeah, and that says something right there.
Well, he's got the most stuff.
Yeah.
And Eric, I think the last three outings, and this is of course May the 10th, have been marvelous.
Yeah, he's capable of that.
Great outings.
Well, the whole staff there for one span of three or four games.
Yeah, about a week there we had great pitching, and it wasn't much going in. Whitson last night had a bad outing, really
sure,
bad outing.
Everything.
What happens with our pitchers is we have an inning that gets out of control and they don't know how to curb it. You know, good pitchers like Gaylord Perry is an example. Have the bases loaded, nobody out, and give up one run. You know, you get one guy and then somebody'd score or a double play ball and he's out of the inning.
Yep.
But we don't have pitchers that have that kind of control. What happens when we get the bases loaded and one out, they get four runs.
Yeah, that's the problem. But this Roberto Alomar is going to be a second baseman.
I think he's going to be a marvelous. I think he's going to be an excellent major.
What does he do that everybody is raving about beyond what some other...
He can make the double play. You can turn the double play, but few people can do it. There are more pretty good second basemen around now than ever before. It all happened this year. They got Lean, they got Alisea, they got Alomar.
A lot of them are coming from Latin America because they're little guys and agile and quick and can do that.
Turning the double play for a second baseman, it's a backward play.
Yeah.
And maybe the most difficult thing to find.
That was the one knock that they used to put on Nellie Fox in Chicago, that he wasn't great at the double, pivoting on the double.
He was way below Fox.
Yeah.
He was a hitter. He was an offensive player.
And a fiery kind of leader type.
Oh, no, he was listen, I took nothing away from him, but he was not a defensive player.
Right.
He used to backhand balls. He should have been in front of all day long, and they'd never get errors.
Yeah.
Now then, have you, seen at all the book called Voices of the Game by Kurt Smith?
No, I got one and I didn't read it, but I should read it. In fact, I had a nice lunch with Kurt. He came up from Washington to Philadelphia and we spent 3 hours talking, and he embarrassed me. He knew more about me than I knew about me, you know, and everybody else, you know, and he knew everybody's average, and I thought, oh my God, this guy ought to be a
His research is fantastic. I haven't read much of his book either. I've got a copy, and I delve into it every now and then, but...
I should read that because it has a lot to do with my business, the beginning
it does.
Days, and I just haven't gotten around to it.
It's got a
I kind of
it,
avoid those things. This is a different book than that, but all these... These biographies and so forth, are, you know, I look at them as being self-fulfilling, really, more than anything.
What do you feel about the, like in Voices, he spends about a page on slips of the tongue that you've made?
Well, I don't, you know, those kinds of things don't bother me because I'm comfortable with what I know about the game. And I don't feel, well, no, I mean, you know, I kid, I say, well, if they ever have a bust of me, I'll have a pointed head. But I get excited, and I probably say a lot of those things, and some of those things, I've looked at them, I said, oh, well, you can make out of that whatever you want to make out of them. But
I think it does
not bother me. But we have a man in our town who sits and writes them down. That's all he does.
I know. I've heard about him.
Consequently, I'm sure if he, you know, I must have got his attention early on, but... frankly, I've never met the man. He's never said hello to me, and I don't know who he is, and I don't really care.
Nah, hell no. The one I like the best is when you said Rich Folkers is throwing up in the bullpen.
Well, you see, when I said that, he missed an um.
Missed what?
He missed an um. Throwing him up in the bullpen. You know, and I know what I said because I said I didn't.
Talk to you about baseball today. What about free agency?
Well, it's changed the game. No question about it. I think that the only bothersome thing that I have about baseball today is that the players are really controlling the game.
Yep.
And
it's
I think
it went from one extreme to the other.
It's the pendulum is so far it's ridiculous. And the thing that bothers me is, and I've said this over and over again, we have restrictions for players. If you make $1 million, you have a bad year, win two games instead of 20, they can cut you 20%, only 30% over 2 years, or release you. And most cases with a pitcher, sometimes you don't want to do this. Now, my approach to that is very basic. Okay, you guys want to go from 200,000 to $1.5 million. That's fine, but if you, in that 20-game year, make that jump, if you only win 3 games, let's take you back any place we want. See, you're restricted. And they have no capital outlay, they have no expense outlay. They get paid regardless, no matter what the club does in a down year.
And even if they want to release them, generally it's a guaranteed contract.
Yeah, in many cases it is. But you see, my approach is very basic. Okay, you guys want all this money, fine, we'll give it to you because... You know, you earned it.
You earned it.
The Minnesota Twins earned it last year.
Yeah.
So you all want $1 million, fine. Now this year, we find that, oh my goodness, because we're playing bad, we're going to lose $3 million. So let's see, you were always 5% of that loss. So, you know, they don't have any loss staring them in the face.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, you can take this back to years past when the owners just stepped all over the players, and that was wrong.
Yep.
There's got to be a middle ground in here. But to me, when you, as an owner, have $30, $40, $50, $100 million in capital outlay invested in something and are controlled by the workers, I think that's why it's almost like the unions, you know, which I'm not against unions, but I think there's got to be a middle ground so that a guy who's putting all his money up has a chance to get the rewards. And it's part of our country's capitalistic approach to life.
Absolutely.
But I really think that free agency has changed the approach of the player, and it's a proven fact that long-term contracts destroy, in most cases, the player's capability.
And motivation.
And there's a player up in Boston right now who has not hit a home run,
yeah,
who's getting $2.3 million a year and is laughing stock. He's never been able to play. He's been a hitter.
I don't know
not
how long his contract goes for, but they don't need him anymore.
But there are all kinds of players like this, and baseball made a mistake.
Yeah.
In running at these players and giving them longer. In fact, in San Diego, when they signed Garvey and Gossage, they knew what would happen the last 2 years. And they did it anyway. For the plus of the first three. That's crazy. And players perform better when they have that double chasing them down the street. There's no question about it.
And arbitration is an extension of the thing.
Well, arbitration, the problem I have with arbitration is the people that are arbitrating
don't know
first base from third base. Well, they do, but they're looking at numbers. And numbers, believe me, I've seen 280 hitters that are more valuable to a team than the 400 hitters.
Of course.
And you can't measure it in numbers, and that's all they do now. They sit down, they chart it. 3 years in the big league, these numbers and that, you get this. And 4 years, you get...
Yep.
It's stupid. Because numbers don't mean a damn thing.
Couldn't agree more. What about artificial turf?
Well, I don't like it personally, but I guess it saved you from rainouts. And it's
how the ball players feel.
Well, let me tell you something. Artificial surface came in for football players to save the knee injuries, and all it does is create more. It's like playing on concrete. The players hate it.
The only thing it does is it avoids a lot of rainouts.
Saves rainouts, that's all. Frankly, to me, of course, if you have an indoor arena, you have to use artificial surface.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So in the Metrodome and the Kingdome and in the Astrodome, it's got to be inside and it's got to be artificial. But basically, I think that it has no value in the game to me except that it changes the game.
Changes the game.
Not to the better, in my opinion.
Not to the better. So wrong. What about the strike zone?
Well, they're now back to the high strike, or so they say they are. When I quit, the strike zone was at the level.
Absolutely.
And last year it was at the belt.
You're damn right.
Pitches at the belt were called balls. And
I
no wonder there were all those home runs. Now they've raised the strike zone a little bit. The umpires can go up on it, and the guy pops up instead of hitting a home run.
Umpires haven't fully lifted it, though.
Each umpire is
going to do it his way.
Pretty much. You're not going to get some of our umpires or low-ball umpires to raise that strike zone because they're down low. Part of the reason why the strike zone was so high in the American League was in the old days they worked with behind that little mattress and they stood over the top.
Yeah.
Now it was harder to see down, but the National League umpires who always had a low strike and worked down in a crowd for the inside protector.
What about the ball crew?
They had it in 1950. I was in the game. The Vic Rashi set the record. They did the same thing then. They went and enforced the balk rule. They got a pause, and then they rewrote it to a moment instead of a second. And you see, I don't mind the balk rule if it's uniform, but right today,
it's not going to be.
There are six teams in the National League. One team at 30 balks, one team at 27, three teams at 10, 11, 10, and 9, and another team at 6 balks. So there's no continuity there. See, in other words, this is the National League. The American League was more uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing, the balk is put into the baseball rules to not deceive the runner. That's what a balk's all about. Okay? Now, when you balk Nolan Ryan in from third base, who are you deceiving? You think Nolan Ryan's going to steal home?
That's
stupid.
One.
You know, I mean, that's a game. Cost him a game.
Yep.
You balk the pitcher. Nolan Ryan is 41 years old, in from third, because one guy balked on an intentional walk. True story.
It's hard to believe.
With walking a man intentionally, and he went too quick, and umpires. Now that, you see, umpires are people.
That's ridiculous.
Some are very smart, and some are very dumb.
Yeah.
And some have no concept of the logic of things.
Mm-hmm.
So the balk rule is all right, but let's use a little judgment like everything else. You've seen officers who work out of the book. Or the worst kind.
Yeah.
The officer who understands the law and can sort of move with the situation as a guy you want.
Mm-hmm.
And some umpires can do it and some can't. They're just stuck in that book law. They don't understand.
That's right. What effect do you see in the expansion from 16 to 26 teams up to this point?
Well, you know, people say that the talent is diluted and that's all. Well, let me tell you, when I played, there were eight teams in the American League.
Mm-hmm.
There were two divisions in that league.
Yeah,
you had the Yankees, you had Detroit, you had Cleveland, and you had the Red Sox when I first came into the league. And then you had Washington and St. Louis and Philadelphia and Chicago. They were terrible.
Yeah.
And we would play them 22 times. And if we didn't win 18 or 19, we were really upset. You know, they had bad clubs.
That's right.
They didn't have anybody in those teams.
There's much more parity now.
Well, you know, let's go back one time I started. Well, 40 years ago, there were, say, 160 million people in this country. There were 230 million.
Yeah.
But what the hell? You got 70 more million people to draw from your talent pool anyway.
But there's another.
The black athlete.
That's right.
Changed the world.
Hispanics.
Hispanics, too.
Hispanics. But there's another side to the coin. Even when you came in, baseball had a near monopoly of athletes.
Every athlete that could play went into baseball.
Now there are a hell of a lot of athletes that could make it big in baseball that are over in football, basketball, and other things.
Yeah. I don't know. So I don't see the talent diminishing that much. I see a lot of pretty good players out there, believe me. And the black athlete and the Hispanics have changed the world. They're all over the place, and they're great athletes.
Yeah.
And, you know,
there couldn't have been that expansion without a real watering down of the quality without the blacks and Hispanics.
Well, the first year there's a watering down, but now we're going back to 69. Yeah. 20 years ago. That thing has been, you know, dissolved by now.
What about further expansion? Suppose they go to 32 teams.
Well, you're going to have the same thing for a few years, and eventually it'll level off, you know.
I think so.
You see, we have a big country here.
Yep.
I remember when I was growing up, the United States had 120 to 130 million people. We doubled that. And we were playing with 16 teams then. But you're right. Jim Thorpe went to play baseball. All the football players played baseball. That was where there was money.
Right.
The only other place to make money was in boxing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, golfers didn't make much. Basketball wasn't even in existence. The pro footballers were people who couldn't get a job.
Yep.
Or, you know, the Red Grangers who were promoted as the big guys. The rest of them were just a bunch of guys who didn't want to work.
Now, there's even another aspect to it, I think. In those days, every town, village, and hamlet had a town team. And nowadays, they still, to some extent, but not that way, because there's the television and radio, and they're watching those games instead of out playing them.
People are so much more sophisticated now, Walter, compared to what I was when I grew up. I mean, kids my age.
Yeah.
At 18 and 20 are light years ahead of me. They know more, they've seen more, they've done more, they've been more, you know, all those things.
Even more so in my case.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Boy, I'm going to, next month, I'm going to be 80 years old.
You look like you're 28.
Oh, cut it out. Now, you mentioned your dear first wife. You had children?
I have a daughter, 38, who's a teacher and a marvelous teacher. And has two children, 8 and 5, I think. And I have a son who's chasing rainbows. I don't know what he's doing. He's in Las Palm Springs. He's a bartender, but he's never grown up. 35.
That happens to
him.
And did your first wife die, or were you
divorced? She passed away. And then I remarried and have a little daughter 3 years old.
I knew that.
She's a knockout.
That's great.
Just a knockout.
Wonderful. Yeah.
At my age, it's a miracle.
Now, you're going to go on indefinitely.
I'm going to go on until they throw me out. I can't afford to quit. I'm not that rich, you know. And, you know, I wasn't one of those million-dollar-a-year ball players, so. And besides, Walter, what would I do doing nothing?
Don't think of it.
I don't. I
like
hope that they continue to employ me.
Stay with them.
I have more fun now. I enjoy what I'm doing. I get to do my CBS games.
Even if they made you retire at 70, and I don't think they will.
Well, I hope I'm alive when I'm 60. I'll be 64 in September.
Yeah,
you never know.
Of course, but assuming that you are, you could go back to scouting.
Well, I don't know what I would do, frankly, but I just...
But you got to, from my experience, Jerry, you got to have something to keep yourself
occupied. I would do that. If I was in a position where I could say, okay, I don't have to work anymore and I've got enough income, I still would want to do something. I'd go to a front office and say, would you like to have me scout for you? Or do something, you know, hang around, be a coach on games only. Traveling does get to be a challenge.
Let me ask you this. When you're playing and you're... kids were young.
I don't either.
Was that pretty hard on your wife?
Well, I didn't know it. I was young. I was climbing mountains.
Yeah.
see, and I didn't look around enough. Now I look around, I realize what I missed.
All of the old-time players tell me that. The wives are the unsung heroes of Major League Baseball.
You know, I recall vividly in 1949, the year that we won the first pennant, and Casey was euphoric, and we were all happy as a lamb. He got up at the Biltmore Hotel. We had this great big party, and every celebrity within 1,000 miles was there, and it was exciting times. And he got up, and he talked for 20 minutes about the wives. He understood. See, we didn't understand. Because he was 60 years old. And he understood what they did and what they meant. And boy, you get into a trap with a situation that's tough domestically and it affects you.
Boy,
we were lucky. In fact, the people in my team, you know, all stayed married.
Yeah.
As far as I you know, I mean, you know, Rashi Reynolds, Lopat, Byrne, they're still married to the same wives. Allie's wife died, Earlene. And Rizzuto is still married, and I was until my wife died, and Bobby Brown is still married. Yeah, just endlessly, they're all, Yogi's still, Carmen is there, Charlie and Rose are still there, and Hank and Gene Woodling are married to the same woman. You know, we were lucky. We were lucky. All of those men in that group, I don't even know if there's a divorce involved in
Bobby.
You know, I don't know. There might have been, but as far as I know, we were lucky. We had good women. And it was tough.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, but we didn't know it, see?
Yeah.
Just, in those days, you grew up and you take care of the kids, we'll go out and bring the meat home.
There's so many things that you have to live through before you realize
what they're doing.
And children, as they grow up and become parents, realize what parents went through with them.
Yeah, well, it takes a while. You get frustrated, but I have two really good kids. My son has just been, he's kind of a will of the wisp, but he's a good kid, you know. He's never really gotten into something he likes.
Your career has kept you in touch off and on all the way through with Bobby Brown.
Yeah, Bobby and I grew up together in high school. Like, we were in different high schools, but we played on the same semi-pro teams and played against each other in Leeds and then here and there, and then he and Sarah took off for Texas. He became a doctor, and he still is a doctor, but he was a heart specialist, and I'd see him from time to time, but then now he's back as president. And I said, Bobby, how long are you going to keep this job? He said, as long as it's fun. I'll see him.
Well,
I said, it's still fun. I see him half the time.
That's the best answer, as long as you can survive without the job.
Well, he was...
A lot of people, are caught in a job that they don't like, but they can't give it up because they got to have the
Bobby doesn't need money. He's done well financially, and I think that... I said, I moved to New York for God. Are you crazy? He said, no. I said, and what happened? You know what a doctor's life is. Well, there's no life.
He
lived up for 25 years.
Stepson, who's a doctor right here.
Yeah.
And I've got a granddaughter and a grandson-in-law who are doctors, both of them in Chicago, and it's a rat race.
You never have to, especially certain fields.
That's
The night calls and the telephone going, and people are always sick. And you tell me a doctor that went up to somebody or they came to him and said, gee, I feel great, Doc. It's all this depression you're dealing with. Everybody's sick.
That's right.
Why do they go to a doctor if there's something wrong?
So many things are life and death that are staring you in the face.
I think being a doctor, it's like being a policeman. No wonder policemen are all nuts. I don't mean that literally, but you know what I mean. They're alone. Well, that
Jerry, I will keep you. Thank you.
I got a couple things to do. And,
I appreciate very much your time. And
I made contact with your daughter through somebody accidentally. She's in a publication. Is she with
she's
the Smith
with
thing?
No. Diamond Communications.
Yeah, but there's some way I
daughter-in-law.
Got her card. Daughter-in-law. I got her card on something. I forgot what it was.
They published Voices of the Game.
That's where I got it.
Published my book. Published the biography of Larry McPhail.
Mm-hmm. That was a good book.
Little
known thing that nobody ever knows anything about, and a big piece of baseball right there.
Yeah. And Earl Lawson's book called Cincinnati Seasons, they published.
And I don't know, they've got a few others. Brickhouse's book and Harwell's.
I haven't. Cozzani, I see occasionally.
Yeah.
Jack, I haven't seen in a long time.
Well, I saw him a year ago, the last time. He's doing okay, doing fine, in fact, and still has radio spots in Chicago.
He used to show up at the Cub games, even after he wasn't doing the games, doing something, and suddenly he just disappeared.
Well, I think he was a little unhappy that they put him out to farm.
It comes that time for all of us, and you got to accept that and go on to other things.
Exactly. Yep.